Good morning. இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் துவங்க இருக்கிறது. மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகர் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்னை அன்பர்கள், அமைதி காத்து அன்னை அருளை பெறுமாறு வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம். ஃபர்ஸ்ட் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
Good morning. I agree that can concede to some extent that up until now we've been talking about chapters, Supermind, Divine Maya, Satchidananda, which lie beyond the personal experience of most of us, maybe except for rare glimpses. But certainly that doesn't apply to this chapter. This chapter, he talks directly to our experience. So we are all qualified to ask questions and to answer them as well. This is not so much a chapter on philosophy as he talks to our most profound interests and the deepest depths of our concern about what we're doing here. And how did we get into this thing called life? What is life? Is it good? Is it bad? We like it. We want it to go on and on and on. But it's full of so many complications, which he summarizes in the title of this chapter. First of all, there's death. What's the idea that the divine should give us such a wonderful thing and then take it away and tell us from the beginning this is a term loan, has to be repaid, this is a contract, this is not the lifetime employment, this is the limited employment. And then he gives us full of desires, unsatisfied desires. And if he's so great, why doesn't he give us all the capacities we need to have and do anything we want? Death, desire, and incapacity are the bottom line for us. Why? Where did they come from? So we can literally say that this is the subject matter of this chapter is a question of life and death for us. So it's important. So let's not miss any essential truth in the chapter. And it's very fair to say that the knowledge he gives in this chapter doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. This is not restating what anybody has explained up until now. In the last chapter, he talks about what he now tells us is the first term of life. I was wondering why there are four chapters on life. First one called life, then this one, death, desire, and incapacity, then the ascent of life, and finally the problem of life. By which he really means the solution, not the problem. But why four chapters? Well, it turns out there are four terms of life, or if you prefer, four stages of life. I also wondered why in the last chapter he talks so much about the plant. After all, that's not our main preoccupation. We like flowers and trees and all, but what about us? Why is he talking so much about the plant? And he even talks about the mineral and the elements. Why is he? It's all very fine, but that's pure philosophy. We want to know about us and our life. But it was very important that he talk to us about the plant and the mineral, because that is the first term of life. And he tells us, normally we don't consider the minerals alive, we don't even really think much that the plants are alive. Of course, we know plants are alive or dead, but we don't really think of life in the plant. We think of ourselves, the animals, as alive. We don't mourn or feel sorry when we harvest a paddy or pick a flower that we're taking life. But he says the atom, the plant, the mineral, the metals are charged with life. That's important for us because Only then we can understand what life really is. This is the first term of life. Life has involved itself in matter, in the material forms of earthly existence. Life is evolving. You'll see from this chapter, we find out we're some way between the second term and the third term. I don't think we're very far along the way, but at least we can congratulate ourselves that we're not entirely at the animal level. But our salvation and our fulfillment comes by going to the fourth term. So we'll understand that better if we start from the beginning and understand what life really is. All things in nature are alive. He goes and says, all forms of energy in the universe are forms of subconscious will. That means lightning, electricity, the waves in the ocean, the wind, the storms, the cyclones, magnetism, chemical energy, nuclear energy, anything you can think of is a form of subconscious will. What does it mean? It means we don't think those things are conscious. We don't think somebody's deciding to put the lightning bolt or to send the cyclone. But there is an intention, there is a will behind it, meaning it's alive. Because if there's no will, then it can't be alive. And if there is a will, it has to be. Something is alive. Some form of life is there in wherever we see energy. And he says even the atom is surcharged with energy. The molecules are surcharged with energy. Everything in the world is seething, teeming with life. This chapter traces the evolution of that life, which we can see in matter, in the elements, in the molecules, in the lightning, in the waves, in the wind, in the plants and the flowers, traces it up through the animal kingdom to us. We who are subject to death, desire, and immortality. So that we can understand not only where we've come from, but we can see the path and know where we're going. And hopefully, because of this knowledge, we'll have the right direction, and we'll get there a lot faster, because we know there's a direction. Whereas, in the tradition, not only this tradition, but in all traditions, there is no direction to life. We're here for some time. Maybe it's by one version, it's an illusion. Maybe by another version, it's a cycle of suffering, like Buddha said. Maybe it's a temporary staging before you go to something greater in heaven. But life is what it is. Life is not going anywhere. But he tells us life has a purpose, life has a direction. And our goal is not to get out of life, run away from life, go to some higher moksha. Our goal is to pursue that evolutionary direction so that life can fulfill its purpose. And our life, the subject to death, desire, and incapacity, can become life divine. So he's talking to us now. We are all experts on this subject. So life has started with the plant and the animal and the minerals, but at that level it's completely subconscious. In the second term of life, which is, we can easily think of it as the life in the animal kingdom, but it describes us to a good extent. Life manifests not just physical movement and physical reaction. The plant turns towards the sun, it seeks the water, and so forth. It manifests desire and sensation. You call the dog, it comes. When it's hungry, it's barking or looking for the food. Every animal is hunting either to protect itself from being caught and consumed or to catch something to feed itself. So desire and the will for survival is what we see in the second term of life. This is what Darwin studied, and he came to the conclusion that life is a question of the survival of the fittest. Everybody's competing with everyone else. The strongest and the fastest dominate over the rest, and that's life. And there are a lot of businessmen who will tell you that's the way things go, and maybe politicians will say it also. And maybe even in the marriage market there's something like that also. We all compete for the best games. But he said, this is only the second term of life. And as long as we think life is like this, and as long as we want to play by the rules of this game, we remain in the animal kingdom. We never become fully human, no question of becoming divine. So the sooner we realize that Darwin was right about the animal, but he's not right about us, the sooner we stop being compelled by the jealousy of Carolyn and the domination of Lady Catherine and the competitiveness of Lydia, who wants to be the first married, we begin to come out of our problems and move towards the third stage and have a hope of getting to the fourth stage of divine life. This chapter is going to explain to us why death, desire, and incapacity are our middle names, why we are subject to them, how we can get out of them. He's going to tell us we have to overcome the original perversion, and he's going to explain to us what that is. But first, what is life? Where does it come from? Why was it created? He says, life is an operation of conscious force. Conscious force means chit. Chit means the middle term of Satchitananda. He's not talking about our consciousness and our force. He means the divine. The divine in manifesting a universe, the being self, puts forth a conscious force, chit, for the joy and delight of existence, ananda, and what we call life comes from them. Maybe our life doesn't seem to resemble very much what we imagine as Satchidananda, but the truth is, that's the source. Not only the source, that's the goal. The goal is not that we go to the highest heavens of superconscious to be in Satchidananda. The goal is that our life becomes Satchidananda, that we discover this, but that's the starting point. Life can become divine because life is divine in its origin. And we talked in earlier chapters, he told us that process, how the being puts forth consciousness, how the consciousness puts forth knowledge and will, and that knowledge and will, which are the powers or extensions of consciousness, create real ideas, the intentions of the divine being that it wants to manifest in the universe. And that's supermind. Supermind is there to create a universe to fulfill the intentions of Satchidananda. And supermind has all the power to do that. And we also read in earlier chapters that mind, this thing that's causing us so much problem and confusion, doesn't work very well. Mind is actually a subsidiary power of supermind. He told us there's a divine mind, and then there's something more familiar to us, the creature mind, the mind in the ignorance. And he explained the difference between those. The divine mind is conscious of the fact that it's one with everything. The divine mind is conscious of the fact that it's only an instrument of the divine. The creature mind is where we in our best moments live. We're conscious of the fact that we're separate from everybody else, that we're different from everybody else, that we're all alone sometimes, that we have to take care of ourselves, and that the divine, if it exists at all, is something very different, far off, and unintelligible to us, unknowable to us, inexplicable to us. So we are in the ignorance because we have forgotten, we have lost the link between mind and supermind that tells us who we really are, why we have come, what the world really is. And to make matters worse, this ignorant mind that lives for itself has an energy, has an intention, has a will. It wants to survive. It wants to put forth itself. It wants to live and accomplish and grow and master in its individual body. And that's what we call life. But that life, that energy, that force, that intensity that it's putting forth is really the force of Satchidananda. It's the knowledge, it's the will of supermind. But instead of using that will for the expansion of the universe, I'm using that will to take care of myself, to do what I think is good for me. So Wickham comes and starts sending scandals about Darcy, and before that he tries to elope with Georgiana, and then he causes a catastrophe by running away with Lydia. This is the life run amok. This is life lost all sense of its purpose. In fact, causing problems not only for everybody else, but most of all for himself. Unfortunately, Wickham is not the only one who behaves that way. We all know that Mrs. Bennet is constantly doing things that end up, we say, shooting herself in the foot. End up causing problems. She wants Elizabeth to marry Collins, and gets so, schemes so much about it, Collins runs away, marries Charlotte, and takes the entail away. Charlotte's going to become mistress of Longbourn because of Mrs. Bennet. So, unfortunately, it's not just a story, and we don't have just three characters. Every character in the story is acting according to the ignorance of their own mind, doing what they think is good for themselves, causing problems and limitations for themselves and everybody else. And the chances are pretty good that if it's true for all the characters in the story, it's true for us as well. Because we are an ignorant life following the ignorance of mind, of a divided mind. So he tells us, life with a capital L is force, is power, is will. And the question naturally arises, if we have a life which is force and power and will, why do we die? Why do we find we have so many desires we can't satisfy? If it's the divine will that's acting in us, then we should be able to get anything we want. Why should we find limitations and incapacity everywhere? That's the key, the answer he's going to give us in this chapter. Life is divine in its origin, but not in the way we're living it. So it's not life that should change. It's we who should change. So why is life that way? Well, he explains to us, it's this way because the first act of creation was for the divine to involve itself, to self-absorb itself and become a material universe in which its consciousness and even its force are buried in conscience, below the surface. If you go to Mars or if you went to the Earth a billion years ago, you wouldn't find anybody walking around, no animals or anything like that. It looks like a dead place, the way Mars and Venus look today. It's just matter. No sign of life there. But we know life is there. Life is buried in matter, sleeping in matter. Every atom is surcharged with that life, but it's not yet come up. The life we know, the life of the plant, the life of the animal, has emerged out of the matter. It's coming up. It's revealing itself. You can say it's waking up. Matter woke up to become the plant. The plant is woken up more to become the animals of all the different types. Darwin was not wrong in that sense. And we are animals who are waking up to the fact that we're more than animals. We're thinking animals. We are aspiring animals. And if we listen to Sri Aurobindo, we'll discover we're actually more than animals. We are in essence divine, and that is our destiny, to become divine. So what we need to do is wake up our life. Wake up the consciousness in our life. And if you look back at the mineral and the plant and the animal and the human being, you see one thing is clear. The more conscious we become, the more powerful we become. In an earlier chapter, I think it was Ego and Duality, Sri Aurobindo talks about the arboreal ape. The arbor is the forest. The ape in the forest, if somebody had come and told him, say, 10 million years ago, that one day you will be building cities out of stone, ships that sail the sea, airplanes that fly in the sky, and rockets that go into outer space. Of course, he wouldn't have understood any of these things at all. Just would have had a blank look on his face. Because consciousness and power of consciousness was very limited in the ape, even if it was the most advanced animal up until that time. Now look at what human beings have done. Apart from the pollution and the corruption and all the problems we've created, we've shown that we're far more powerful than all the other species before us. Not just because we have two hands and we speak a language, because we are more conscious. So if we want to overcome the limitations of death, desire, and incapacity, it's not by more muscular exercise or more machines and technology that we're going to do it, or even by more reading or collecting more gold or better marriages, it's by becoming more conscious. Because consciousness is the source of will and power and mastery. Every day I don't feel very cosmic and universal. I feel pretty much stuck in my bed, in my body, in my head, and with all the limitations. So in the creation, and it figures the way to enjoy infinitely is to multiply itself infinitely and to enjoy in every one of the forms that it multiplies. So, though we look like we're not a very promising species, and we're far from divine, even if we're a little better than the animals, the goal, the purpose, the intention, the inevitable destiny is each of us should become a center for divine manifestation. Each of us should, that's why he says, why do you want to worship God? You can become God. Because God wants to become you. God is you in essence. God is emerging and awaking in the human being, in each of us. That's the soul. That's the psychic being. We don't have to give a very high opinion of ourselves or be megalomaniacs to say that we want to be divine. That's what divine wants for us. That's what our soul longs for, to manifest and discover its divinity. So our problem is that the cosmic conscious power of the divine has become divided and individualized. That's not so much the problem. The problem is that in becoming individualized, we forgot the truth of our being. We said in earlier chapters, using the analogy of Jane Austen, when Jane Austen creates this story, and when she becomes an actor in the whole own story, and then when she believes she's really Elizabeth Bennet, or worse than that, if she believes she's Lydia, or Mrs. Bennet or Lady Catherine, and that's all she is, then she's really got a problem. Then she's subject to death, desire, and incapacity, because that's not her true being. If she says, no, no, I want to be Lady Catherine for the rest of my life, or for the rest of eternity, you can be anything and everything. Why do you want to be subject to that limitation? So the problem for us is to awaken to what we really are. We are not just individuals cut off from everybody else. We are individual points of a global, universal, cosmic manifestation. And everyone else is not just an actor in our story that's here to help us get along or give us trouble. Everyone else is another form of our own being. Is also us. The truth of our existence is we are everyone, we are everything, and we are more than that. We are the divine, which is beyond that. Okay, we can have our individual preferences, we have our different colors and foods and things that we want to be different, but let us try to discover the truth where we are one. And instead of fighting the rest of the world and causing problems for ourselves and other people, let's find out what the divine is trying to accomplish through each of us and manifest in the universe. So individuality, which is the key to our fulfillment, is also the source of our problem. Because we're individual in the ignorance rather than individual in the knowledge. When the divine is awake in us, when we know there's the Ishvara inside, when the psychic is fully conscious, individuality will not be a problem. It will be the greatest thing because we can manifest infinitely the creative powers of the divine and the delight of the divine, and so can and enjoy everyone else who's doing the same thing. So our problem is we're individuals stuck in the ignorance, thinking that we're separate from everybody else. And that individuality has two aspects. First of all, our mind is individualized, meaning I look at everything from my point of view. I think about how am I going to solve my problems and why won't people appreciate my efforts and give me credit for what I do and cooperate and for me. Everything happens, I look out through my eyes the way Lady Catherine does. When she hears that the rumor that Darcy may be wanting to marry Elizabeth, she says, what about Lady Anne? She never stops to think whether Darcy wants to marry Lady Anne. Or for that matter, whether even Lady Anne wants to marry Darcy, or Lady Anne is capable of marrying anybody. That's a question so simply. Can she be a mother? Can she be a wife? She needs a full-time nursemaid, even at the age of 21. To take care of her. And what about Darcy? Doesn't he have a right for fulfillment? Or does he only exist? No, my daughter must be married to Darcy. She must be mistress of Cumberland. That's mine in the ignorance. That's mine looking at everything from his point of view. And Carolyn has a wonderful viewpoint of everything. She's figured it all out for all of us. Bingley should marry Georgiana, and then Darcy should propose to me, and I should marry him, and everything is very fine. And why does this Jenny Bennett come into the picture? How can she come in and spoil things? And this Elizabeth Bennett, I don't like the fact Darcy's looking at her. He says he's admiring her fine eyes. What fine eyes? Why should she come in? Why are they spoiling my scheme of things? That's individual mind in the ignorance. Looking at everything from his own point of view. But it doesn't stop there. He said, life, our life comes from mind. It is an individualization of the will of our mind. And what we call desire is really our divided, ignorant mind having desires and trying to fulfill them in conflict with everybody else. So Wickham says, what am I going to do for a living? What am I going to do for success in life? This certainly is a nice place. If I can elope with Georgiana, all my problems are solved. Of course, he forgets the fact that old Mr. Darcy was so kind to him, took care of him, raised him, almost like a son, made him a godson. He became the godfather of Wickham, and offered him a living that was worth at least £1,000 a year, like Collins had. And he forgets all of that, all the sense of loyalty or gratitude he owes to the Darcy family, and he wants to spoil everything for them by running away with this 15-year-old girl who's too young to know any different. That's when our individual mind in the ignorance drives our individual life, our idol in the ignorance, to do what it thinks is good for itself, and ends up giving trouble to everybody, including and most especially Lisa. And of course, Mrs. Bennett's a good example for us. Her aspiration has brought four eligible bachelors that could have all become members of the Darcy family and of the Bennett family in a respectable way. Everything she does cancels opportunity. Whatever happens good happens in spite of her. Her aspiration was there, but her ignorant mind and ignorant vital will only cause problems for herself. That happens to be our problem, too. So what is this thing called life? Life, he says, is the energy or the force that builds up forms in the universe. Life is that which is built, created the material universe. It's created the atom, the mineral, the metal, and all of the mountains, the seas, and everything we see. The force for creation is universal life. But life is not only the energy that builds up forms, it's also the energy that tears them down again. If it builds up mountains, it can have earthquakes, it can have the winds that erode the mountains, it can have the earthquake that destroys the mountain in no time. It is all the energy, both of creation and destruction. It's the energy that creates the plant. It's also the energy that when the plant dies and goes back to the earth, breaks down the plant and converts it into fertilizer for the soil so that it can become, the soil is rich and fertile to grow something else. If life did not break down the plant, we would have no soil in the universe. We'd have no place where you could grow anything. Because what we don't grow it on sand, we don't grow it on granite. We grow soil means where material matter is mixed with organic material from previous life forms that have been broken down into their basic elements so they can become rich food for other life, like us. If it wasn't for all of that, if it wasn't for all the millions and billions of life forms that have lived and died and gone into the soil, we'd have no patty today, we'd have no brinjal today, tomatoes or any of that. We want. We also thrive on that. It's life that creates the form. It's the energy of that life contained in the form, and it's that energy which breaks down the form. So it's the same energy. Life is also the energy that we exchange between the forms. When Darcy comes and proposes to Elizabeth and essentially says, I have very good news for you today. This rich, important man is going to marry you. So I just wanted you to know how lucky you are. And he hears something he didn't expect to hear when she says, Mr. Darcy, it's very kind of you to propose to me, but you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. And then the sparks begin to fly and it becomes a real combat. Where did that energy come from? Both of them are quiet people keeping to themselves, but when they relate to one another, it's an explosion. And we see even a greater explosion when Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn and says, I heard this rumor, Miss Bennett, don't try to fool me, that my my nephew Darcy is planning to propose, has proposed to you, of course you must deny it and refuse, and then it becomes a fireworks display between them. Where does that energy come from? It's the energy of life in the form. Not just in the physical form of the body, but in the vital personalities, in the desires, in the mind, in the understanding of the people. But every form, especially ourselves, we can understand that we're full of energy. Energy, our physical energy that keeps the body healthy, our vital energy of desires and urges and emotions and feelings and sensations and sentiments and our mental energy of ideas, aspirations, and so forth. In fact, the whole form is full of energy. When we're sleeping at night, people may not be able to tell the difference between our body and a log. But the truth of the matter is, life for us is full of energy. And when we interact with others, even positively or negatively, that energy flies, the sparks fly. That's exchange of energy in life. And he's going to tell us that the crucial truth of life, that life grows through the exchange of this energy. We don't just grow by eating. We really grow and become alive and human through the exchange of energy, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. We seek that spiritual inspiration. We seek that emotional support. We seek knowledge when we can get it. So life is a constant interchange of energy between forms. We are attracted to people with high energy because of that. We say it's very lively. That's what makes Lizzie very attractive to Darcy. It's not for her money, we know. It's not for her social position, we know. He said she was only tolerable. It's certainly not for the dirty petticoat because she goes through the mud. Or her fur. It's certainly not because she has a wonderful mother or very cultured sisters. He's attracted to the life in her. She's lively. She's full of vitality. She's exuding energy. And that attracts him. And that energy attracts us and is attractive to all human beings. Whether you like the movie star, what makes movie stars attractive? Not because they're good people, not because they're very cultured, not because they're living wonderful, noble lives. We feel their energy, that energy energizes. But why does the political leader go out there and the masses just shout and run or even make products to his sandals on occasion? Because the leader embodies the energy and is receiving the energy from the population, and they feel energized when they listen to the leader telling them how wonderful they are and how much he's going to do for them, giving free TVs to everybody. And why should you pay for food? You are so deserving. You deserve free food, free clothing, free education, free TVs, free housing. And I'm the one who's going to give it to you. So people feel energized by that. We draw energy from people. Jane draws her energy from Elizabeth. Jane's a nice girl, good girl, pretty girl. She's got no energy in her life. I wonder whether Jane would have ever gotten married if it wasn't for the fact that Lizzie is so determined that she be married. Lizzie is it's Lizzie's energy and interest and affection that energizes Jane. We give our energy to others. Mothers, literally, you all know better how much energy you give to a child to give it life. Teachers to their students. So life is an exchange of energy to build up forms. Then he tells us, life is also that, not only that goes in and out, but life is that which connects our mind with our body, connects mind and matter. It's the intermediary. When the mind thinks, I would really like to have a mango, It's the energy of the vital that goes out and moves the body to do something about it. When a mango is there, it's the mind sees it. It's the through the perception. It's the vital that is the source of that sensation. It's the vital that executes that sensation. So if we didn't have life, we might be a disembodied mind that's floating up there, seeing everything, but incapable of acting on anything. But he told us the purpose of this life is, the purpose of the creation is, that the divine should be able to live fully in the material world, all-powerful, omniscient. So it needs a force to do that. It needs an energy for execution, and that's life. Not this human life which we're using to maintain our body, to compete with others, to be socially popular, or to study, but the divine life that will be all-powerful, so that matter, the physical world, can become a field for divine manifestation, divine life. But right now our problem is that our lives are subservient to an ignorant mind. Unless we're going to clear it up here, it's not likely that things are going to improve. We look at the animals who don't have much of a mind, and they're not doing much better than we are. They're fighting and quarreling and killing and just living like animals do. Hopefully we can do better than that. If we're going to do better than that, it all starts with our mind. We have to think differently. We have to be different. We can't be only thinking of, I have to look out for myself and everybody else is a competition for me. There's only one mango and there are so many people. How do I get it for myself? We're going to have to change our thinking if we want to elevate our mind, elevate our life. And then he tells us, the original source of our problem, original source of our problem is that we are exclusively concentrated on being who we think we are, that is this limited surface egoistic self, living in the body and thinking everybody else is not us. This is where we have to change. Unless we reverse this perception, we can never come out of the ignorant life. We will never escape from death, divine desire, and incapacity. This is the source of our problem, the ignorance of our consciousness. We live as selfish individuals, isolated from everybody else, and as long as we're that way, death, desire, and incapacity are the rule. But that's not necessary for us. We are meant for more than this. We're capable of more than this. We can overcome the original perversion. And I'm sure you will recognize everything Appa says, everything that Mother advises, every strategy is to help us come out of this ignorant view of things, ignorant consciousness of things, not just so we can be good people and good children of Mother, so we can become infinite, so we can become divine, so we can overcome all problems and limitations. It's not for the sake of the world that Appa is asking us to do this. It's not for this. It's for our own sake, so we can really come into our own and discover our potential. So now, we come to death. Okay, why death? Now I understand why I'm making foolish decisions all the time and getting into trouble the way Wickham and Mrs. Bennett and Lady Catherine do. But why death? Why, if the divine wanted a divine life, why did it invent death? He tells us, again, first time anywhere is explained, death is actually a process of life. Death is not the opposite of life. We scratch our heads. Death is not the opposite of life. From the day we're born, from young age, we're told there's a bad news at the end of the line because it all ends. It looks like the opposite to us. He says, no. This is a error of our mentality. We don't understand the crucial role of death. And when we listen carefully, he's going to tell us. He's going to tell us death is essential for our life. Now we're really talking confusion. Death, which we've learned to fear try to avoid and run away from as far as possible, death is absolutely essential for our life. What does he mean by that? He says that the disintegration of forms, which is what we mean by death, the body dies, is essential for the perpetuation of life. And that all life goes through a continuous process of disintegration and renewal. We know even in the body, I mentioned the last time, that the cells of our body are constantly changing. This is not the same body we had a few years ago. Some cells do it faster, some slower, I think. I forget it right now. There are some cells that die within 15 days, some within 15 weeks, some within a few years. Even the bones of our body are not the same as the ones we had 10, 20 years ago. There's a perpetual process of change. Then he says, consciousness does not end with death. That's very encouraging to us to know it's not the end of the line. It certainly looks like that. When you say go over the cliff, it looks like that. But if you read Mother's Agenda, she has so many stories. There was one story I read recently. Story means a real story. A disciple who died and didn't know he was dead. And he came rushing to Mother. He said, Mother, Mother, they're taking all the furniture from my room. Please stop them. I don't know what they're doing. He doesn't even know that he's dead, but he sees that the furniture is missing from his room. Many of them come to Mother directly after they have left the body, cling to her, meld into her, so she can take care of them until they're to be reborn again. These are her personal experiences. Consciousness doesn't end with death. When I go to sleep at night, my consciousness ends for a while. And I wake up some hours later and I start again. I didn't die during the night, but I lost consciousness of it. Death and life, even when we're unconscious. If I were more conscious, I'd remember all my dreams during the night. There was a time when I could remember for hours where the dream started and go back. Mother gives a way to do that. It takes a lot of effort and concentration. No, I had a very busy night. Mother never loses consciousness when she goes in bed. She closes her eyes from the time she closes her eyes to the time she gets up. She knows what's happening, where she's going. She says she did her best work at night while people thought she was sleeping. So depending on how conscious or unconscious we are, we may lose consciousness of what's happening during that period. It doesn't mean we stop existing. We never stop existing. And when we wake up, we continue the process that the soul's journey is intended for. He says, nothing is wasted. There is no waste in nature. We see the form. The idea that this body that I've been taking care of and feeding and exercising for so many years may have a limited purpose is not very pleasing to me. It can be even quite frightening and terrible to me. Please don't touch it. It's all I have. I value it very much. But what we will find out is this becomes a limitation to us for our progress. It's there as an instrument. We should use it as long as we can and make the maximum progress we can from it. But a time comes when it becomes a limitation. And we have to understand why it becomes a limitation so that we can minimize that and use each life to the maximum. And one of the things I hope you'll get from this chapter is life is so precious. It's the most precious thing we have. Not because we only have one. It's the most precious thing we have because it is our opportunity to discover who we are, to realize who we are, to make the maximum progress so that our soul can come out so that we can discover the delight of existence. That's why human beings are the only ones who have this opportunity. So we have to make the most of this. Not because it's short and then it's over, but because we're given it for a purpose. And if we're not pursuing that purpose, we're missing the whole value of life. So why is death necessary? He says, the soul comes seeking an infinite experience in space and time. Why? Because that's why the divine created the universe. The divine is infinite. It wants to manifest itself infinitely. It can't do that in one place. It can't do that at one moment. It does it by becoming millions of souls and each one having an infinite experience, a growing experience, an evolving experience that gets better every day, that becomes more powerful, more aware, more enjoyable, more delightful at each step. The soul wants to continue to progress infinitely, but it starts off in a finite body, in a limited space, in limited time. If you're born as Wickham, your opportunities, you may have infinite opportunities, but it's limited. You're the son of the steward of Pemberley. You're not born as Darcy, who's got everything. If you're born as Darcy, you have a big estate to take care of. You have a younger daughter to take, a sister to take care of. Your parents are gone. You have big responsibilities for all the people who depend on you, all your tenants and everything like that. You can't be a free, you can't become an artist. You can't be writing novels. You can't be doing many things. No matter how lucky we think Darcy is, actually, you see the story, he's really a kind of a pitiful character. He's sad, he's stiff, he stands aloof. The only time he ever smiles in the whole story is when she accepts his proposal. The only time he ever laughs is after that. His whole life was not something very envious. Those of you who would like to have been Darcy, or Lady, how many of you would like to have been Lady Catherine? You've got this whole big rosings, and you can command so many people, and you can have so many colleges around you that flatter you and agree with everything you say, but it looks like a pretty... So any one life has great limitations built into it because of the circumstances. The soul wants infinite experience. It can't get that infinite experience if it's stuck in, if it's Carolyn or Charlotte or Bingley. Each has an opportunity for a rich experience that will help the soul's progress. But no matter who the person is, where they're born, when they're born, if you were born 40 years ago, the people born today seem so lucky. The generation born today, what are the opportunities they have that you as parents never had? And think about what you have been achieving and where your parents achieved, or grandparents achieved, or those who were born before freedom, when you couldn't even, you were so limited. So each place, each time, each family gives an opportunity. But the opportunity of being born as Georgiana to Darcy without parents, the opportunity, I guess we can say it was an opportunity for Lizzie to be born as the daughter of Mrs. Bennett. She got some energy. She gave her a pretty face. But certainly there were a lot of limitations there too. No matter who you think of, what situation, when, what it offers is limitation. And what the soul wants is unlimited. Why? Because our potential is unlimited. And our capacity for delight is unlimited. So any form we take, any situation, even if you think somebody's much luckier than you are, it may look like that on the surface, is limited. The truth of the matter is, the circumstances we have are what our soul has chosen. The family we have, the conditions we have for our maximum progress. There's no place that we should better be. There's no person that we should be who's going to be luckier for us than ourselves if we give up our ignorance and take advantage of the life that we've been given Because we have each been given what the soul needs for the maximum progress and the light of existence. He says death is essential for spiritual evolution. Why? Because we grow up knowing that we're going to die. Supposing there was no death, then what's my incentive to do anything seriously? So you better work very hard, because then you're going to have to retire, and you might get ill when you're later, and you have to have some savings for that, and you want to have family, somebody will take care of you in your old age and everything. Because I know I'm limited, and I look back and say, my gosh, I wasted all these years. What have I accomplished? I better do something with my life. Why did I come here? This must be something. I don't know what's there afterwards. Because death is there, we strive. Because death is there, we want to keep improving ourselves and mastering ourselves. And when I was a youngster, I never thought of death. I never think of death. But now I count the years, I count the months, I count the weeks, sometimes I count the days. Not because I'm afraid of dying, but because what am I doing wasting my time? I wasted another day, I wasted another hour when I could be making a progress. Can I be luckier than I am? I know Mother, I know Sri Aurobindo, I know Appa. Grace is all over, literally, everywhere. How can I afford, can I ever have a better opportunity than this to make a maximum progress? Because I know it's got a limit. There's an end. Not an end for my soul, not an end for my evolution, but this opportunity I should make the most of. Without death, we won't have that spur. And he tells us, life is food. It's a funny thing, but if you think of it, that's what we know. We consume food to be alive. We consume food to take the energy from that food for our life. So we take the form of food. Food contains energy hidden in substance. We take that in order to live. And at the end, sometime, our body dies and becomes food as substance for other life. So everything is recycled. Food is, the body is, the food of the life force. We consume our body. When we're not eating, when we're exercising, or we're very busy, we take the substance of our body and convert it into energy for our life. So actually, it's obvious, matter is only another form of life. It's a form in which the energy is stored, like a battery. Now we take that battery to express it. We eat other life forms, whether vegetable or animal, for our existence. And other life forms eat each other, consume each other. There's a constant process of mutual devouring, one form being broken up to support another form. The form changes, but the life, there's no such thing as death. When we say death, what we mean is the form breaks up. The life energy that's there in the form, it only changes form. We say the paddy plant died so that I can have supper. But the life of the paddy plant has become the life for me, so I can be animated and motivated for my life. And I say, I met that person and I tried to help them. I was very exuberant, and now I feel exhausted and I've lost everything. What I have lost, the other person has. And because I have given, I can receive more. That's another thing. Life is never lost. Nothing is ever lost. Only the form changes. The man who earns money says, I have all of this money. Now you want me to give it to you. He feels like he's being murdered, like he's being robbed. But the truth is, money only has value when you use it for spending. You can keep it in your house. You can only sleep on it under the mattress. If you're on a desert island, that money has no use. It's literally useless for you. Money is only has value in exchange. Life energy only has value. What? For our experience. If we're sitting at home, I understand if I go out, if I meet people, if I do things, I use my life energy up, I'm going to save it all. I'm going to save my library like Mr. Bennett and live the rest of my life in quietude. Each time I meet my wife, she drains my energy. Each time I think of Lydia, my mind twirls, spins. I just want to be quiet and read books and keep a happy, peaceful life. What's he missing? He's missing life. He's not living. He forgets why he's there. He's there to learn from that experience of being the lucky grace of being Mrs. Bennett's husband. How much he has to learn. Finally, he does learn something during the story. He becomes a better man. He has to learn from that experience how to be a father to Lydia and not do stupid things like send her to Brighton. That's what his soul has come for. And when he sees that after 25 years of patient tolerance, quiet, genteel behavior towards his wife, that his daughter, his favorite daughter, becomes mistress of Pemberley and he becomes a regular guest there. He says, you know, maybe I thought this 25 years was a waste, but it seems to have been worth living. And Jane has married Bingley and she's at Netherfield and I got three daughters married. I've not spent one peso. Just, life is a miracle. I was hiding all this time. Foolish. So let's not be foolish. What are we here to learn? He says that death arises. He says death, why did the body die? Why does the life die? It results from imbalances, from disharmony. Either we take too much or we give too much, and we don't maintain the proper balance. We can understand that physically. When we don't eat enough, the body starves and we die. When we eat too much, we get all types of diseases, which is what's happening in the population now. The more prosperous we are, the more new diseases are being invented. And a sign of Indian prosperity is diabetes is becoming becoming world record proportions because there's no balance between the intake and the outflow. The food we take in is meant to be converted into energy and expressed in life. It's easier to eat than to express our energy creatively. So we have an imbalance. That's a physical imbalance. We can also have a psychological imbalance. Lady Catherine enjoys very much sitting at the Rosings and having people come and bow down to her, if not physically, at least psychologically, and listen to her rambling and babbling all day long. She feels very exhilarated, and she thinks that she's gaining a lot. This is a good arrangement. What happens? Her daughter, Lady Anne, is just shrinking, just wilting like a plant that's never been watered. Because in truth, she's never been watered. Her mother is taking all the energy in. Nothing is going to the child. There's nothing that goes out from Lady Catherine. The whole world is there to serve her and oblige her. She says, what's the idea of having Rosings, having all this power, importance, prestige, and wealth, if there be no child to, if my daughter doesn't marry and have offspring and have a continuation, it all ends with me. And that's the truth. It's going to end with her. It's going to end with her because it's the imbalance of a one-way street. It should end with her. The life and society of England, which built up this great aristocracy of leaders to make the nation great and make it a world empire, is doing so that every aristocrat can be a king and have thousands of people serving them. They did it so that everybody can become a king. Everybody can have prosperity. Everybody can be important and have rights. And until then, it's right. It's necessary. Either the aristocracy should lose their heads in the French Revolution as they did across the English Channel, or they should just dissolve, they should die out of, because they become feeble, they become sick, they become diseased. That's what happens to Lady Catherine. That's what was going to happen to Darcy's family. Because the parents are dead, his sister is almost lost. He's like a piece of petrified wood, if you've ever seen petrified wood. There's no life in him, he's more like stone than wood. Fortunately for him, she comes and wakens him up. She sees the fine light in her eyes, she's impertinent, she pokes him and teases him and abuses him. And awakens his soul, his passion, and suddenly you see this petrified wood is a plant with flowers. And he's going and performing miracles to help other people and to come out and awakens from the aristocracy, the goodness, the nobility, the truthfulness, the generosity that was there inside, but it was destroyed, it was decaying. And now it's reawakened. It's reawakened by marrying with the next class. Her mother is from the middle class, not even, at least her father is a gentleman. Mother's from the middle class, but it brings the energy, the freshness, the vitality to revivify the aristocracy, not so that it can go on dominating everybody else, so the whole society can evolve, become richer, more cultured, more prosperous. It's the whole society that should benefit. So the decline of the aristocracy was essential. I'm sure most Indians today would agree that the decline of the British Empire was quite in order. When you talk to a Lady Catherine or a Winston Churchill who said, I will never preside over the decline of Her Majesty's Empire or the dissolution of Her Majesty, for him it's death. That death is the life of India today. The greatness of India today, the energy that we enjoy today is because the British Empire died. Britain didn't die, the English people didn't die, an old form died. So that greater energy, greater creativity. The English are more prosperous today than they were 50 years ago. Far, far more. There's no comparison. And more of them are prosperous, as India is far better off and more prosperous. That's the necessity of changing the form until we outgrow the need to change form, meaning until we stop behaving like Lady Catherine and Mrs. Bennet and petrified Darcy. When we understand what we should be doing, then death is no longer necessary for us. We can keep progressing without going through this thing that looks very frightening, like jumping off the edge of the cliff. He says that life aspires for mastery. There's a lot of question in the tradition about life, and it's better to deny life, become an ascetic, ignore life, suppress life, because it's all something low and bad. Desire is the source of all the problems, Buddha said. He said life aspires in each of us for mastery, because the divine aspires in us to express its infinite power. The difference between us and the divine is we want all the mastery for ourselves so we can dominate over everybody else the way Mrs. Bennet wants to dominate over Lady Lucas. And Jane's marriage should be, her success should be Lady Lucas's failure. Whereas what the divine wants in each of us is that everybody should marry a Bingley and a Darcy, everybody should become a mistress of Pemberley, everybody should achieve at the highest level because we're all one, we're all divine. So the aspiration for more is not wrong. The urge for growth is not something to be ashamed of. But the way we grow has to change. Because the way we grow now is, as divided separate beings, we want to grow by struggling with everybody else. Oh, there's a rich bachelor has come to Meriden. Mr. Bennet, quick, get it for my daughter. There's not enough men to go around. I want Oh, he said, oh yes, maybe he'll marry Elizabeth.
Mrs. Bennet says, no,
she can marry Jane or Lily. Even in the family, they're competing. That's what has to change. The problem is not that we want to more. The problem is not that we want 100 drawers. Papa will be happy if you all really want 100 drawers and wake up every day with a burning desire for 100 drawers. The problem is, we want to be the only one who gets 100 drawers. And if we find out that somebody else got the 100 drawers, we feel depressed, desperate, disheartened. Either I'm a failure or that man cheated, probably did something wrong I would never do. We don't realize that one person getting 100 crores is our victory. It's the surest sign that you get it later. That's why Appa has given the strategy. If you really want the 100 crores, pray that everybody else gets it. Not only pray for it, work for it. It's the surest way for it to come to you. Why? What's the magic? Why this crazy inverse formula? Because the 100 crores is not staying away from us for any reason except that we want it only for ourselves. That's the attitude is what keeps the 100 crores away. So if you reverse the attitude, you don't have to do anything. The money will come by itself. But because we're stuck in the body, because we're in this individualized form, we think, no, if I don't take care of myself, who will? I must look out for myself. You think anybody's just going to give this to me? Darcy did give it to Elizabeth. She didn't do anything. She didn't do anything except abuse him and go after Wickham. She didn't do anything to deserve it. The closest we see in the story is Charlotte really wanted Jane and Lizzie to do well. And Charlotte was the first one married. And how interesting, she got along. And Lizzie, who's never thinking of herself, of her marriage, is all the time thinking of Jane. Jane is not thinking of Lizzie. Jane is thinking about Bingley and how can I get Bingley. She's quiet, polite, and sweet, but she's thinking of herself. But Lizzie's all the time thinking only about Jane and how can he get Bingley. And what happens? When she least expects it, Darcy comes and says, be mistress of Cumberland. Trying to devour others, dominate others, take from others, to one in which we happily give to others and receive from others. He calls it mutual self-giving. The individual gives to other individuals through generosity, love. The lower gives to the higher by surrender, by obedience, by loyalty, so that the higher can give to the lower by leadership and inspiration and knowledge. The human gives to the divine with devotion. The divine gives to the human with grace. We give the faith. Mother gives the grace. All of us as individuals, we give to the universal. If I take the position, everything I do must only benefit myself. Nobody else should benefit by anything I do. See, I had a great idea and now everybody's talking that idea. I invented some very nice thing called the cell phone. Now everybody has one. They've stolen my invention. What good is my cell phone unless everybody has one? Only when everyone has the cell phone, my cell phone is valuable to me. The more we think our life, our place in life is to give to everybody, then the whole world will give to us. So desire. We have death, we have desire. Now we have incapacity. He says, because we are limited, because we are ignorant, we are constantly feeling our limitation. How can we not be limited? How can we not have incapacity when we are the all and the universal pretending to be only one isolated individual? Our incapacity comes because we limit ourselves. And we think, if when Appa says, you can have 100 crores, every devotee says, how can I have 100 crores? Who's going to give? I'm just a small person. We insist on our limitations. That limited person cannot have the 100 crores. When we realize our infinite being, at least when we realize mother is infinite, we qualify, we overcome our incapacity. We constantly focus on our limitation. So we are limited. So, in summary, he says, our problem is ignorance. Ignorance is the basis of our desire. Ignorance is the basis of our incapacity. Elizabeth believes that Wickham's a good man. Definitely she'll have problems. Mr. Bennett says it's better you let Lydia go to Brighton, otherwise there'll be no peace here. It's no wonder he has a cyclone come through his house. He insists on his ignorance. If we lived in the knowledge which is there, which the soul has, we wouldn't spread lies like Wickham does, thinking we're very clever. We won't fall for Wickham's handsome appearance like Lizzie. We won't make the mistake of calling Lizzie tolerable, especially within hearing of it. If our mind has the knowledge, we won't be struggling and craving and trying to outsmart everybody else to get what we want, because we would know that everything that should come to us will come in the right time when we have faith and when we're true. We would know that even our failures are only a preparation for greater achievement. And without those failures, we would never achieve more. Papa is reading the biography of Steve Jobs, who has founded Apple Computers, which is now the most valuable company in the entire world. And the author very rightly shows that Jobs' great achievement was not so much because of his native talent, but because he had great failures from which he learned. And without those failures, he would have never achieved what he achieved. So, how many valuable lessons we have for ourselves? Have we taken all the knowledge from our failures? Have we learned everything we can? It's a rich fruit. It's like bank accounts. It's like gold bars. We should take the value out of our experience. Death, desire, and incapacity will disappear when we rise above ignorance and strife and transform it into love. Lizzie did it in a little way in her attitude to Jane. Darcy did it in a big way by reversing his attitude toward Mrs. Bennett, Lydia, Wickham, and Mrs. Bundegaard, and so many other people. At a human level, at least into the, he rises from the vital second term into the third term. But it will really come when we recognize that everything that happens to us in life, every challenge, every clash, everything that comes to us comes to release the delight, to give us the knowledge for our soul's progress. And every minute we live is a great opportunity for that. So in sum, he says, we live, death, desire, and incapacity are the trinity, the three forms of being a divided being. Not because we're in separate bodies, that was the intention, but because our consciousness is separate, our minds are separate, our emotions are separate. In other words, egoistic. So he summarizes and says, death arises from the seeking of the individualized consciousness for immortality. What we must do is, as the individualized consciousness, we must seek to universalize. We must seek not how can I live forever, but how can I live for everyone. When I live for everyone and in everyone, my life will become immortal. Desire arises not because I aspire, because I'm seeking infinite delight, because I'm seeking my own infinite delight. If I seek the infinite delight for everybody in and around me, my desire is transformed into love. Ignorance and strife come because I act out of that ignorant lack of understanding, rather than having the knowledge of my true self and the true purpose of my life and my role in the world. Darcy woke up. Darcy got the knowledge. He reversed himself. You can say he transformed himself. And he went from petrified wood into a man who was melting with the emotions of divine delight when she accepted his second proposal. To apply this chapter to the topic of money, because I think there's a very practical way to do that. Before I do that, I had asked everybody for questions and all, and more important than my saying anything more, if there are any questions, we'll take them first.
Good afternoon, sir. I want to share one experience. Actually, more than 100 years, when we near the tidal park, the Adayar Kuvam, that is drainage water. So now they change the drainage water into a boating, good water, and they are doing this. Whenever we cross that, it suddenly remember Appa Birdi, that change and incapacity. So I will relate the both the thing, and I will feel the bliss whenever I cross the, that place. So whenever I face a problem of incapacity or to cope up with the change, I will recollect this. So drainage water can change as a good water. So everything is possible. Thanks a lot. There is no limitation.
It's a wonderful example. I remember the coup when I came in 71, and for many years and decades, what it would look like, and worse, what it smelled like. So it's a great example. Life is physically being transformed.
Commentary on Principles by Jane Austen by PNP Volume 2, Part 2, Page 24, 27, written by Appa. Leadership, even the world leadership, is available to one who excels in others, even by an inch, in any field of endowment. Britain is... His lead in the 17th century in trade that gave her an empire was 1% over France and Germany. Rule becomes absolute, especially when the endowments of the whole, often even the partial endowments, do qualify for leadership. The other man's point of view is that America acquiring it in retail sales in the 20th century developed multinational corporations, and now she rules the world. My question is about the FDA. About the FDA. Yes. Because Appa has written it, America is acquiring it in retail sales in the 20th century, developing the multinational corporations, and now she rules the world. I read it in newspaper, even China and Russia allowed FDA in retail and developing countries. See, Aurobindo wanted to become India to become the world guru. To become the world guru, Appa wants India to become a richer and prosperous nation. Richer and prosperous nation. I was confused. The idea of allowing FDA in retail would do good to India to become a prosperous nation.
It's a very good question, and one on which we could have a 15-minute or half an hour discussion, and I would enjoy it. I think there's a truth in FDI. And in opening up, because the whole world can come and bring prosperity here just the way Indian spirituality can go to the whole world. But what would you say if an Indian guru goes to America and says, I bring spirituality from India, and everybody, if you wear ochre robes and grow a ponytail, and you chant mantras all day long, Indian prosperity or Indian spiritual blessings will come to you. Maybe America will benefit something from the Rig Veda mantra, but certainly that's not their destiny. So, are we taking the best from the world and the best that the world has to offer us? If you bring in Walmart and they eliminate millions of small shops, the consumer will be happy because you'll get world-class goods at a much cheaper rate and a much bigger variety. And what you'll find out if you're running another business, that there's nobody to buy your product because all the people who were running small shops are out of business and unemployed. So there's a comment, we said balance. He says balance, imbalance, and disharmony cause death. To remain shut out from the rest of the world. If China is prospering today, it's because they opened up their borders to the rest of the world. There is a right measure and balance by which India can take and learn and benefit from the rest of the world and give to the rest of the world. It should be done in the right measure. It's not closing off foreign investment. We'll lose out on great opportunities. Just wildly taking everything the world wants to give us indiscriminately, we'll end up ruining what we have. There must be balance and discrimination in right measure. So, like everything else, there's a proper measure. FDI is not wrong. Even FDI in retail, you'll find it. You will all want to go to the shops and get real benefits. Money helps us build up social forms, government, companies, entertainment, family. Our problem, he says, is that we identify our life as separate from everybody else's. The same problem we have with money. Each person has money and possesses it as if this is mine and nobody else's and it should all come to me. When we recognize that money is a universal force, it's a form of universal energy, it's a form of universal life, and everything he's told us about life applies to money. In simplest terms, which you've all heard, the more you give, the more you grow. The more we try to possess it, the more it shrinks. The more we deal with it unselfishly and through self-giving, the more it will come to us. It's the very same principle. The more we compete with others in strife, the more our life is limited. At a lower level, with people of lower consciousness, competition is necessary to stimulate their efforts just the way the animal has to compete for food with others. If he doesn't, he'll starve. We're trying to go to the next level where our prosperity comes not because we take it from others, devour others, and consume others, but because we help others grow and energize them. And our prosperity comes because we move from the second term of life into the third term of life. Like money being alive is sensitive. We saw how the plant was sensitive. Schopenhauer said even the mineral is sensitive. Money is sensitive. It's sensitive to our consciousness. It's sensitive to our attitudes. It responds to attention. At a lower level, it responds to physical attention, keeping the accounts right. At a higher level, it responds to our attitudes. So I made a table here. I'm sure if you think of what Abbas says, you'll recognize all these elements. All the items on the left side in red, neglect, carelessness, jealousy, shrinking, selfishness, possessiveness, depression like Darcy, quarrelsomeness like Wickham, impatience like Lydia, doubt, disbeliefs, suspicion, resentment. All of those are things that make money shrink, just like they make life shrink. Take the opposite. positive attention, goodwill, expansive self-giving, generosity, delight. Just enjoying every moment and enjoying everyone and being happy for everyone. Harmony. Calm, patience, trust, faith, gratitude. They not only create life, they create prosperity. Carolyn loses Darcy because she's jealous and mean. Charlotte gets Collins because she has goodwill for Jane and Elizabeth. Elizabeth practices self-giving to Jane, she gets Pemberley. Mrs. Bennet is quarrelsome and dominating and selfish, she loses Longbourn. Wickham wants the shortcut to wealth by eloping with Georgiana. He loses even the living that was given to him by Darcy and has to live on Darcy's goodwill and charity. Jane, if she's anything, she's patient. Calm and patient. She finally gets what she wants. So we can come back to this in a subsequent meeting. But I just wanted you to think about this chapter and realize that everything he said in this chapter is a directly applicable to generating prosperity. Like life, life is a universal force. It's not a thing. We think it's a thing. It's my body. It's not. It's a force that's energizing my body now and will energize future bodies and never will go away. Money is not a thing. Money is a force for accomplishment, a force for power, enjoyment, achievement in society. A force is not to be possessed, it's to be used. A thing can be stored up and hidden and possessed. A thing is to be used, a force is to be used properly. Life grows by exchange and interchange. Money grows by exchange and interchange. I said earlier, if you're on a deserted island, all the money in the world for you is useless. You can't even eat it. You can't do anything with it. You can only say, I'm the richest man in the world, that's all. And there'll be nobody there to admire you. Life is organized to achieve its purpose. Organization of life creates money. The more organized we are in our activities and the use of our energies, the more money we can create. Life, at the third term, which we'll discuss next time, grows by giving. Much, much infinitely more. Money, too, at the higher level, grows by giving. Life is the creation of consciousness. Ultimately, there is nothing, there is no life except what comes from consciousness. Consciousness by itself can create infinite money. It doesn't need anything. At least we have one example in the story that Mr. Bennet takes a decision not to earn money or anything, but he has to repay Mr. Gardner and equivalent of thousands of pounds, tens of thousands of pounds comes to him. She marries Darcy, Jane marries Bingley, they get Pemberley, Netherfield, and even Wickham and Lydia are married, all without him spending anything. Because of an act of consciousness, a decision. What Alpha wants us to do to get that 100 crores is that act of consciousness with full faith in Mother, with full sincerity in Mother, with full gratitude and self-giving. Life is infinite. It's here to manifest divinely. And the infinite manifestation of money is a sign that life is growing into its future destiny. That's why Alpha is anxious that everyone, all devotees, not all devotees, all Indians and the whole world, but let's start somewhere, should get the 100 crores as a manifestation of the hidden infinity of life and the divine life that's waiting for us.